This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, the science of polling and how we measure public opinion. You know, it's impossible to watch the news without hearing the results of a poll. And, you know, the heart of polling, it's pretty simple science. You take a representative sample of people. You ask them to answer a question. What do they think? And you find out from the smaller group what the larger population is thinking. It's really an interesting statistical thing going on here. It sounds pretty easy, but like most things, the devil is in the details. Because oftentimes polls disagree. You have Republican pollsters coming up with different results than Democratic ones. Are some polls not objective, just designed to come up with preordained answers? Is this voodoo science? And most recently, polls have been dramatically wrong, as they were in predicting a win for Barack Obama in New Hampshire. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to take a look at the details. How is a credible poll conducted? What questions do pollsters ask? Who decides what questions should be asked? And with cell phones so widespread now, especially among young voters, and with many polls conducted by, you know, regular phones, could pollsters be missing an important factor, the youth vote, comprised of voters? If you know some of them like I do, they never go near a landline. And that's what we'll be talking about this hour. If you want to get in on the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Andrew Kohut is president of the Pew Research Center. He's also director of the Pew Research Center for the Public and the Press and the director of the Pew Global Attitude Project. He joins us from Washington. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. I'm happy to be back.
Also with us is Charles Franklin. He is professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and is co-developer of the website pollster.com. And he joins us by phone from Madison.
Well, great to be here.
Welcome to the program. Let's talk about polling. Let's start off with talking how a poll is done. Give us the ABCs of conducting a poll.
The ABCs. Well, we start off and we contact a company that maintains a database of telephone numbers. Actually, not numbers, but telephone banks and exchanges, and they draw at random. For us, a series of telephone starts. Basically, they draw a sample of random telephone numbers for us. Now, these numbers don't all have people associated with them. Some work, some don't. Some are associated with businesses, not residences. That's for us to find out when we do our surveys. But the key thing in this draw, in this process, is that every telephone resident in that exchange has an equal probability of being selected and represent a microcosm of the telephone numbers across the country. And we program the random telephone numbers into our computers or the interviewer's computers, and they proceed to call them once they have a questionnaire. We at the Pew Research Center prepare a questionnaire, which is generally a mix of standard questions that we ask. How do you feel about the president? Who would you vote for if the election were being held today? How do you feel about the economy? And so on and so forth. Plus, new questions reflecting what we want to know about in detail on this particular poll. We spend about 5 days and nights, mostly nights, trying to contact people that we've selected at random, as I described. We make up to 10 telephone calls over this 5-day period to each number. That's the maximum that we go to. And we try very hard to get people who are not at home on the first call. We wait a couple of nights, come back to them. We'll do a few interviews during the day. Many people, as you would expect, refuse to be interviewed. There's a great deal of
they just
concern.
Hang up at 6 o'clock in the evening during dinner. That's right.
Yeah, and they say, don't bother me. Right. And if we get a really hard refusal, Ira, we don't call them back. But if it's I can't do it right now, we'll call them back a day or two later and say, is it convenient to do it now? And so we do our interviewing over a 5-day period, and we get a pretty good sample if you compare the results of that sample to the distribution of what the census says about the adult population 18 years of age and older. There are some shortcomings. We have fewer younger people than we should because a lot of those people have cell phones and we can't reach them as easily these days on landlines. Mm-hmm. And we get fewer poorer people, fewer less well-educated people, because they're the kinds of people who tend to refuse these polls.
Let me ask
you
about the cell phone question, because I have three kids. None of them ever go near a landline. You're never going to get them to answer the phone. It will ring until I pick it up. How do you and I know I'm sure they're not isolated instances. With so many younger voters these days, and with the primaries showing how many young voters are turning out like crazy, could you not be reaching and missampling some of these people who do nothing but sit on the cell phones?
Well, two things. First, I want to urge you to have your children get landlines.
They have them. They're in the house. They won't answer them.
I'm just teasing. Actually, we've been well aware of this problem for some time, and it's a growing problem. Back in 2004, only 4% of the age-eligible population, the people that we're interested in, had cell-onlys. Now it's up to 14%. And we've been looking very closely at whether when we go out and interview people on cell phones and then include them in our sampling with the landline people, whether we're getting different results than when we just do landlines. And fortunately, the answer for us in political polling is there's not much difference once we've made our statistical adjustments to the distribution of answers on how you feel about the president or which candidates you support, at least for now, which is to say that the people that we're not getting on cell phones aren't too different than the younger, poorer people that we are getting on landlines. But we are concerned, we at the Pew Research Center are concerned enough about it that we are certainly adding cell phones to many of our major polls. And when we go to sample a population that is heavily cell phone only, for example, Latinos, where the rate of cell phone only is double what it is in the general population, mm-hmm. we make sure that we are calling people on cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Charles Franklin, how do you decide what to ask people?
Well, it's driven by what the current questions are. On the one hand, simple questions like who are you going to vote for, are you going to vote, how do you feel about the president, those, as Andrew Kohut was saying, are standard questions that you include. But you also have topical questions that come and go. Maybe immigration is a big issue right now, but a couple of years ago you might not have asked about immigration because it wasn't currently in the news.
Mm-hmm. But so you actually decide for the country and for the public and for the candidates what issues will be discussed the next week.
That's
by,
right.
By what you ask, you decide. If you don't ask about global warming, for example, the candidates are not going to be asked because it won't be showing up on your poll.
Right. That would be a bit of a burden if I were the one that got to decide the questions for every pollster in the whole country. Fortunately, we have an awful lot of pollsters asking an awful lot of different questions, and there's no easy hegemony there that decides we're never going to ask about global warming, we're only going to ask about some other question. So I don't think there's a big problem with no one asking about global warming, for example. It is certainly the case that by choosing to focus on some issues rather than others, you give more prominence to that. But I actually think that's driven more by what the candidates are saying and what journalists are asking them rather than pollsters having an independent agenda that I only like questions about one topic and therefore I'm only going to focus on those.
Andy Kohut?
Yeah, I would add to that we have a little bit of a check on that, Ira. We make sure, and many other polling organizations do too, that we ask a number of questions which allow the respondent to volunteer answers so that we're not structuring the agenda for them. The most famous of which was invented by George Gallup a long time ago, where we say, well, what do you think is the most important problem facing the nation? And by looking at these questions where people volunteer answers as opposed to our launching off into a set of questions on immigration or some hot topic, we get some running record of what's going up and what's going down in the minds of the public, absent our prompting them or prodding them with what we think is important coming from Washington or coming from the news mm-hmm. business.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring in another guest into our conversation. She is Carlin Bowman, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. She is not a pollster or a statistician, but she studies polls and the measure of public opinion. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Have you been listening at all?
I have indeed.
Anything you disagree or agree with?
I agree with everything that's been said by Mr. Franklin and Andy Cohut. I think they're two of the best in the business. I think that for the audience, it's important, at least as I study public opinion polls, I think they can be a very, very useful tool to understand complex and heterogeneous publics. I don't think that they should ever be used to make policy, nor do I think they're particularly good in terms of predictions.
Yeah. So how would you explain why? And I'll ask all of you this. You see this all the time. A Republican pollster and a Democratic pollster, they wind up with stuff that's favorable to their own party. I mean, polling supposed to be a science, is what I'm saying? Isn't it supposed to be objective?
Well, there are independent pollsters. The Pew Research Center is one. The ABC News Washington Post poll is one. The media polls are set out to be objective, and they don't have we don't have a dog in the fight. We don't represent a political party or a candidate. But the candidate polls, they want good, accurate information so they can inform their candidates how to win and what's working and what's not working. But they also have a public relations function. They want to put the best possible spin on public opinion from the point of view of their clients. And I think that your listeners should pay more attention to independent polls, which isn't to say that candidate polls aren't valid or don't do a good job in some cases, but their objectives are different than ours, Ira. Ours is to tell the story of public opinion. Ours is not to get a candidate elected.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let me get to a phone. Joe in Sacramento. Hi, Joe.
Hi. My question is about the New Hampshire primary. It seems to me these exit polls, the rest of the world uses them to determine whether the election itself was valid. And I'm wondering, considering how accurate these polls have been in every other case, why no one was questioning whether the election itself was not accurate?
Did you hear that question, everybody?
I didn't. It cut out.
He was asking the exit polls, the one in New Hampshire questioned about the accuracy. Everybody was talking about the accuracy of the exit poll. Why wasn't it used to question the accuracy of whether the actual polling results were accurate or not? Maybe the exit poll was accurate, and your results of the real election were inaccurate. How do we know that's not true?
Well, I have somebody else wants to answer.
I think I reflected this question.
Yeah.
This is Charles Franklin. I'll jump in on that then. Two things. One, I think, first of all, there is a recount going on in New Hampshire, so you don't have to rely on the exit polls. The recount is going to go through every one of those ballots, and we'll see how well the recount matches the election day. The second is, I think there's a double standard here. On the one hand, people complain about the exit polls being variable or being off and that sort of thing. But then when it's convenient, you turn it around and you treat them as if they were more accurate than the election count itself. If there are problems with election administration, the stuff you were talking about at the beginning of the show today, those are very serious problems. But the way to assess them is at the ballot box and through audits and through recounts, not through fallible polls.
Mm-hmm. Talking about polling this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow with Andrew Cohut and also with Charles Franklin and Carolyn Bauman. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Andrew, as long as New Hampshire was brought up and they're recounting the ballots, give us your take on what went wrong with that exit poll.
All right, so not with the exit poll, with the pre-election polls. To be honest with you, I still don't know. I was struck by how many things I was able to not rule out, but at least say I doubt that it had to do with a general failure of the methodology, because those same polls got the Republican race absolutely right. It didn't seem like specific techniques were involved, because you had some of the best polls in the business, the Gallup poll, CBS working there, alongside of polls that are much less rigorous, much less well-funded. They all had the same error. It didn't seem like a turnout issue to me, because while there were more voters on the Democratic side, the character of the Democratic vote was pretty much demographically like what it was in previous elections. And it certainly didn't look like you could chalk all of this up to a last-minute trend. 17% of the people who decided that day, voted, decided that day, and they broke a little bit to Hillary Clinton, as opposed to people who decided earlier and they went to Barack Obama. But so it didn't look like last-minute trend. What the question I raised was: this a case where a biracial election brought out the problem that pollsters have had in working in such areas? And I don't see it as so much as respondents who are reluctant to who vote for a black candidate lying to the pollsters, but those people that I talked about earlier that we missed, the less well-educated, poorer people who happen to be Hillary Clinton's constituents, people who are disposed to vote for her, are missed in surveys. And I raise that as a possibility, and only as a possibility, and certainly one that should be put on the table and one that should be investigated. But to this point, we don't know whether that was the issue or any of these other things were the issue. What I'm waiting for is to see how good a job the polls do on February 5th in a whole range of states with different conditions. Now, in South Carolina, the polls didn't do very well again, but they had the opposite problem. They understated, not overstated, Barack Obama's showing. So it certainly didn't look like what I was considering as a possibility back there in New Hampshire. But there's clearly something going on with Hillary Clinton and Obama that's problematic for the pollsters, because the pollsters are doing a very good job on the Republican side.
Charles,
so
put you down for you don't know.
Before we get down for I don't know. Thank
Charles
you.
Franklin, do you agree?
Yeah, I don't know either. We're in a good position to find out with pollsters cooperating, and also the February 5th will give us a great chance to see polling in a wide variety of cases. What we have seen this year is that we've accurately estimated the vote for the third and fourth place candidates consistently across all the primaries. We've done a pretty good job on the second place finisher. It's the first-place finisher, the winner, that we've where the polls have been wrong. They've tended to substantially underestimate the winner's percentage, and that was the case in New Hampshire, and it was even more so the case in South Carolina, where Obama won by a much bigger margin. So I think the point here is that either undecideds are breaking heavily in one direction, and we're not accounting for that in some way. Possibly the compressed primary system is making the short-term dynamics more important than they would be, say, in a general election or in a primary with more time between events. The good news is there's a committee that's been appointed by the National Pollsters Association, the American Association of Public Opinion Research, that will be looking into this and be working with the pollsters who are active to try and figure out what did go wrong and suggest fixes for that.
All right, we're going to take a short break. Come right back. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science and art of polling with my guests. Carlin Bauman is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Andrew Kohut, president of the Pew Research Center. Charles Franklin, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, co-developer of the website pollster.com. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Carlin, let me ask you this question. You wrote in last summer in an editorial in the WashingtonPost.com website entitled Global Warming Not So Hot. Americans think global warming is real and serious. Poll after poll shows there are not many climate skeptics left. The issue has received an enormous amount of media attention, but it still ranks at near the doesn't rank near the top of the issues people want the president and Congress to address. You still agree with that?
Yes, I do. And as a matter of fact, Andy Kohut had a new poll last week, which I think confirms that judgment. The poll asked about the most important problem, a question that Andy referenced earlier, that the nation should address, and global warming was very, very far down the list. And it was also pretty far down the list on the question of whether or not it should be a top or medium-level priority for the administration and Congress. I mean, there were very few people who said it wasn't important. But most people did not place it with the issues such as the economy, health care, the war in Iraq, which tend to have more intensity right now.
Now, how do you square that? In about the same period of time last year, in an article in New Scientist magazine talking about a Washington Post, ABC News, Stanford University poll, found that 7 out of 10 Americans want the federal government to take more action on global warming. Why does your poll say something? And this seems to say something else.
Well, no, I don't conduct any polls. I just look at a lot of polls, including the ABC News, Washington Post poll, and I'm very familiar with that poll, and I think it was done very well. It was done in conjunction with Stanford. I think what they're missing is a kind of intensity that the issue has overall for Americans every day. And so I don't think we really differ. I don't disagree with the results of that particular question, but I'm just saying if you look at the at a large compilation of public opinion polling data, I think the issue does not resonate as strongly as many people would suggest, and I think there are a number of good reasons for that.
Could it just be the way you ask the question, Andrew?
Yes.
I mean, could
yes.
it just be the way you phrase the question? You know, what is the number one issue on your mind? People may not say at the moment, oh, it's global warming. But if you ask them in a different way, they'll say that.
Well, they should, because if they didn't answer differently to different questions, that means that they weren't listening to the questions. These questions tap into different aspects of public opinion, and you can't come to a conclusion about public opinion based on any one indicator, because they are only indicators. They are only measures. Ira, if you and I were having a conversation, you wouldn't judge me based upon my response to one question that you gave me. You'd want to hear all of the things that I say. And if you look at all of the things that the public says about global warming, you will find a pretty complicated set of attitudes. And it's very easy to cherry pick them and say the public is this or it's not that. But we now have enough polls doing enough questions on topics that we have a really pretty rich portrait of how people feel about global warming. And to answer the broader question, yes, people want to see action taken. Most people say they want some action on global warming. The priority, though, that they give it relative to other issues is reasonably low. It's reasonably low because when you look at the views of Republicans, they don't give it the same high priority that Democrats and Independents do, because they are skeptical about the ability to change it, and some of them continue to be skeptical about whether it's real or man-made, whether it's man-made or consequence of natural causes. So it gets to be a pretty complex issue. And fortunately, if you look at the polls, you can really get a rich portrait in the polls in concert, a rich portrait of what public opinion is. And very often what happens in the political discourse, someone grabs a poll finding and says, the public believes this. Well, the public believes a lot of things, and distilling exactly what they mean is an important part of polling these days.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Alex in Milwaukee. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Ira, and hello to the guests. It's a real privilege to be able to talk with these experts. Now, I'm not a statistics person, but I do know about the 95% confidence interval, like when you generate calculating an odds ratio. I've always wondered about the margin of error business in polling. Is the margin of error similar to the 95% confidence interval? And I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thanks.
Okay. Good question about the margin of error. We see them in polls all the time. Let me just ask Charles to jump in there.
Sure. And, in fact, it is the 95% confidence interval. If that doesn't mean much to normal people, except for statisticians, that means that if we did 100 polls, that they would fluctuate plus or minus about 3% around a common mean if we had about 1,000 respondents in each of those polls. The trouble with polling is that there are two sources of error. One comes from sampling, and that's where we randomly select phone numbers to call and randomly select people to talk to. That's extremely well understood, and there's a rigorous mathematical theory of statistics to back it up. But the second source of error comes in non-sampling sources. That's where question wording differences can change results. For example, if we ask who you're going to vote for, we could ask, are you going to vote for John McCain or Mitt Romney or Mike Huckabee, or are you undecided? Or we could leave off the or are you undecided. Well, we'll change the results of that question depending on whether we push people to give us answers or whether we invite them in to say undecided. So those sources of variation from poll to poll aren't part of the margin of error, the 3% or 2% or 4% margin of error. And that leads to further variation in the polls.
So what makes you decide whether to ask if you're undecided or not, or to push it?
Partly the judgment of the researcher. Some researchers, especially academics, I think, believe that it's correct that large percentages are undecided, and you want to reflect that. We saw that in an extreme case in South Carolina last week, where one poll showed 36% of the sample is undecided. The trouble is, in choosing to do that, it meant that they estimated much lower percentages for Obama and for Clinton than would have been the case if they had pushed that 36 to say, well, who do you lean for? Or if you had to choose right now, who would you vote for? Different purposes can legitimately reach different conclusions about how to ask that question. The trouble really comes when we have a mix of pollsters using broadly different questions, then we get, not surprisingly, widely differing answers.
Do you think people now are suspicious of polling more than they ever have been before?
We don't see too many questions about the polling business. The few that we've seen suggest it has a middling rating, I think, generally.
Okay. What do you think, Charles?
Well, Ira, I think one of the real issues here is the politicization of polls. In the last few years, we've seen partisans on both sides choose to attack the polls and their credibility whenever those polls produce results that their partisan preferences would rather not see. And some of that is perfectly legitimate. The issue about cell phones is one that, for example, the Pew Center has spent lots of money studying. The Gallup poll now incorporates cell phones. But those are convenient axes to use to bludgeon polls that come out with a result you don't like. And I think that is something that's become more prominent in the last few years compared to the past.
Let me ask a question about this coming Super Tuesday. Andrew, are you going to be doing more polling on Monday than you did in New Hampshire?
I didn't do polling in New Hampshire, and we will not be polling in the primary states. That's not something we do. I have done this when I was at the Gallup organization and other places. We're polling this weekend to find out which direction, if I detect trends in the among the national public. But my guess is those folks who are polling over in the states are going to keep going because they don't want to do everything they can to not be caught short and to not miss last-minute trends.
Carolyn Bauman, do you think that polling should be doing more polling on Monday? In your opinion?
I'm sorry, I missed that last exchange. We had a little technical problem with my mic. I'm sorry.
No, I was just asking. There were people who were saying that the reason that the polls missed the New Hampshire change was because the polling stopped over the weekend. It did not go on Monday.
Well, I think it's certainly helpful to poll for as long as you can before a race, and certainly with as many hotly contested races as we have on Super Tuesday, I think many pollsters will be trying to do that.
Okay. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's talk about some science issues here. Let's say stem cells, let's talk about stem cells, for instance. If you want to know how Americans feel about stem cell research, you can get different results based on how you ask the question. Wouldn't that be correct, Andrew?
It would be, but one of the things that we found out about stem cell research is that when we started asking about this in 2002, 2003, most people hadn't heard about the issue. We started asking them if they had heard about the debate about it, and most people said not too much. The public was then leaning against the idea of using human embryos for stem cell research. We tracked both sets of questions, how much have you heard about it, and what's your disposition? And we found as people learned more about it, heard more about the debate of the issue, that we got a majority of people saying they favored such research.
But if you phrase the question how do you feel about using embryonic stem cells to do research, that's very different from asking a question, if you knew a family member could benefit from a cure based on embryonic stem cell research, would you be in favor of it?
Well, yes, but
would you ever ask it in the second way?
We would ask it in a variety of ways. If you're doing an in-depth set of questions about stem cell research, and you want to start first with a very neutral question which gets to what people are thinking without prompting, then give them a variety of scenarios to see what moves public opinion. But the bottom line is to try to at least start out with their basic disposition on the issue, figuring out how much they know, distinguishing between people who've thought about it and people who've not thought about it, and then go further into the complexities of the issue. Again, the same point I was making earlier, you don't judge individuals in conversations on the basis of one question. Mm-hmm. We don't judge the American public on the basis of one question.
We're talking about polling this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. With Andrew Kohut, Charles Franklin, and Carlin Bauman. I heard CNN in the last election, I guess it was New Hampshire, I think it was, had something called an entry poll. I'd never heard of that before. I guess they must have asked people before they went into the polling booth?
That was in the caucuses.
The caucuses.
It was in the Iowa caucuses.
Does that give you a different result than an exit poll, and why would you do that?
They want to do that because when you have caucuses, you have people going in, and they may come out with a different answer based upon the negotiation that goes in within at least the Democratic caucuses. And so the desire was to see how they went into the process. Voting is much different than caucusing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carlin, what do you say to people who think that polling should be done away with?
Oh, I think that would be a big mistake because I think, as I suggested earlier, it's just a very valuable tool to understand complex and heterogeneous publics.
1-800-999-8255. Ryan in Denver. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. Hi. I'm a psych, political science major, but some of the questions that I've kind of had about polling involve how your guests would respond to the idea that people aren't really rational actors, and that what they're trying to do is they're trying to take a poll of how individual people react as individuals to these issues, when in fact the mounting evidence shows that people don't really react as individuals to these issues, that it has a lot more to do with their interactions with their community and their specific social groups.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I guess in many ways, the polling data is much like how we try to predict markets, in that we're trying to predict the ebbs and flows of people's reactions. And very similar to polling, we tend to find the trends that we find in markets in general, which is when they're wrong, they're really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They're right, they're occasionally right, but yeah. we tend to overemphasize the times that they're right.
Mm-hmm. Charles Franklin?
Well, I think there is an issue of how much social processes push individuals around compared to their preferences. Caucus is actually a good example of that, where you have to stand up in front of all of your friends and neighbors and declare who you support. There may be some effect of that, but it doesn't seem to show up in the polls being systematically wrong for that reason. I think the bigger issue is what we've touched on a minute ago, that two things. One is, it's wrong to believe that the public has only one single idea about an issue. Something like stem cell research is multifaceted, and different parts of the issue have different answers. The second is, it's wrong to assume that everyone in the public has well-formed, strong ideas about these topics. Some of the lack of ideas is due to ignorance. You just don't know much about the subject. And some of it's due to ambiguity or ambivalence about what the right answer is. How do I trade off the rights of one group against the rights of another? And so I think the idea that there should be a single answer is wrong. But I think, secondly, the idea that everybody holds an opinion about every issue we could possibly ask them about is also wrong.
What do you do about someone who has an answer that's not on your question? It's not part of your answer, as a response that you don't have a choice for?
Well, often that's taken down verbatim as an other category, and if it shows up at all frequently, then it'll be accommodated. An example of that is, it used to be, back in the 60s, we asked people if they trusted government all of the time, some of the time, or all of the time, most of the time, or only some of the time. So many people started volunteering none of the time that it eventually had to be added to the questionnaire.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, quick last few words.
Yeah, the notion that the polls are always wrong is wrong itself. The national polls have been doing a terrific job in measuring, estimating the national presidential elections in 2004, 2000, and 96. Even though we're struggling with a more difficult job of getting people to cooperate, barring these exceptions of South Carolina and New Hampshire, the polls have a very, very good record in recent years.
All right, I just want to put
that on the record.
Okay, you're on the record, and we're out of time. Andrew Cohut, president of the Pew Research Center, Carlin Bowman, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Charles Franklin, professor of political science, University of Wisconsin, and co-developer of Pollster.com. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome.
Good to be here.
This program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Ned Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Shuman Ma is our Metcalf fellow. And our technical director today is Neil Rausch here at the controls in New York. If you'd like to write to us, send your letters to Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Or surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Stop racing, Ira. And you can podcast and send us all kinds of email there. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.